Welcome to episode 27 of Forest Focus. I'm your host, Paul Wade, with the Regional Public Affairs and Communications Office. National forests are loved by many people for many things. Beyond the recreational benefit they provide, we will tie in episode 22, Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, with another amazing benefit carved into the national forest landscape, history. Historical markers can be found throughout California's forests, parks, cities, and towns that speak towards the Native American tribes that lived off the land, to the pioneers who surveyed and explored, and to those who shaped what California is today. In this episode, we will focus on Chinese heritage sites on your California national forests. Calling into the show today is Fred Wong, a district ranger who manages the Mammoth Ranger District on the Inyo National Forest. Fred, give the listeners some background on what I'll refer to as the epicenter of the topic today, the Asian Pacific American Heritage Collaborative.
I've been working for the federal government for about the last 20 years, a combination between Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. And when I was with the Forest Service while working for the Stanislaus National Forest, our Asian Pacific Employee Association in the Forest Service decided to start up what is called the Asian Pacific American Heritage Collaborative. And that was around 2015. And one of the goals of the Heritage Collaborative was to find different ways to engage underserved communities, specifically the Asian Pacific American community, what I call APA. And, you know, if you go hiking around national forest lands, you don't see that many Asian Pacific Americans using recreation too much. They're not, you know, really that enthused about it. So we were trying to find different ways of trying to engage the APA community. And one of those ways that we thought of was to highlight some of the cultural heritage resources on National Forest Service land. When I did some research, a lot of it tended to happen in California was within the late 1800s when the Chinese pioneers kind of came over and started looking for gold in the gold rush. However, after the gold rush was over and there was a lot of discrimination against them, working in other areas in the kind of like the more organized gold hard tunnel sites, they started branching out into different other areas. And in primarily in California, that's where we kind of focused on. And so that we kind of focused our attention on that. And we wanted to be as inclusive as possible to include other Asian Pacific Americans. But as far as cultural heritage is concerned in California, that tended to be the focus. And so that's where we started. Okay, well, let's take a look at some of these sites. And we found an amazing number of sites, both from the Forest Service side and the BLM's Bureau of Land Management side, and even private. And so we wanted to somehow highlight these sites to attract underserved communities to visit some of these sites. And so the first thing that we came up with was the website. And so we got a partner, the Chinese Historical Society of America, to help us with that. And we got some Asian Pacific American interns to help us fan out into these sites to record more information about them and take pictures of them. And so now we have ended up with that website, which has probably over about 100 sites on there. So we're really proud of that.
Well, let's talk about that website. ExploreApaHeritage.com. Clicking around the site, looks like you can look up sites, heritage sites by state, counties, land ownership, features. And speaking of features, connecting it with the California National Forests in the region, I'm seeing Sierra, El Dorado, Lake Tahoe, Stanislaus, Mendocino, San Bernardino, Inyo, Plumas, Modoc, Six Rivers, Los Padres, Tahoe, and even the Humboldt-Tioga, which is Region 4, but it dips into California. All of these places have these Chinese heritage sites. And we're talking about walls, dams, water ditches, ranching, roads, mining, flumes, and even wine caves in the Napa region, all the way up to railroads, which we'll get more into a bit later. In my just simple clicking around, I counted around 52 sites, and clicking on their About link is quite interesting. Tons of information, really good historical background information, and again, we'll get more into some of that here coming up. But what I noticed was the collaborating partners part. And in that group, Fred mentions a few, there's one called the 1882 Foundation. So joining us on the show, calling in, is Ted Gong, Executive Director for the 1882 Foundation. By the way, their website is 1882foundation.org. Ted, I was wondering if you can just jump right in here with a few things. Explain the foundation, its connection to the Chinese exclusion laws that were enacted in 1882, and then how you linked up with the U.S. Forest Service to provide more opportunities to see these Chinese heritage sites on national forests.
That we needed the Congress to apologize for the Chinese exclusion laws, which were first enacted in 1882. So we just gathered together and says that Congress had rescinded the laws in 1943, but they have never apologized for it or acknowledged the harm that those laws did. And what that act did was exclude Chinese from immigrating to the United States, and Chinese who were in the United States were prohibited from becoming American citizens because they were, according to Congress, unassimilable and they shouldn't be Americans. So it's the first major immigration law in the United States, and the first one and only one to exclude a people by ethnicity or nationality. No other people have had that designation before. Long story short, in 2011, 2012, we got both the House and the Senate to pass unanimous resolutions condemning those laws. There needed to be some kind of sustained education effort. Otherwise, they pass the law and they forget it again. Nobody remembers there was that law or the policy for the law. And we go back to square one. So the idea was 1882 was to be a foundation that continuously promoted awareness of the 1882 laws and the continuing significance of those types of laws of exclusion. And we do that through things like three major projects or initiatives we have, which is uncovering and preserving oral histories and story sites, historical sites. We do work on curriculum development, lesson plans, and teacher workshops. And we convene a group once a year, Asian American history, historical societies, and museums to talk about best practices. So within the first group, that is finding oral histories and preserving historical sites, that's how we got involved with the people that have stories, that tell stories. And at one time, we met with Dale Hom, who was doing the API heritage tours with the Wing Look Museum in the Seattle area, the Pacific Northwest. So he was running tours of various sites, the mining sites, the different other places where construction sites, lumbering sites, different things where Chinese laborers were working on. And many of those were, of course, on Forest Service lands or lands by Bureau of Land Management. But you find the traces of those sites, but you don't know what the stories were. So Dale had this idea that he would do tours working with the Wing Look Museum to provide historical stories or accuracy and the background to those tours. So they were just one-off tours. I think that he had connected with Stanford University and some other people. It emerged from a conference that talked about how do we preserve these stories and how do we collaborate with the storytellers or the people who are the stewards of the land. So the other conversation that we were having in the 1882 Foundation was just in terms of preserving stories and how you fund and finance things. We began to think that, course, a lot of these things are funded by federal government grants and so forth. But we needed to have some sort of sustaining ability, public-private partnerships. And also, we wanted to have people actually visit the sites. So we wanted to develop in our teaching process and learning process things like history and places. Places themselves could tell the stories, and you can actually visit the sites. So we had to figure out, we were working with these issues, and we gotten connected with Dale and his heritage tours, and we began to support other similar tours. And so the next one was to try to do it beyond the Pacific, the Seattle and the Pacific Northwest area, go to the place where the stories are Chinese, or where the riches, and that was in California and Nevada area.
And when you finally have that structure, Ted, you obviously expand from there. You start searching for partners and looking at the websites, both the 1882foundation.org website and the exploreapaheritage.com website. It shows that there's quite a few organizations that have assisted through this process, which are the Chinese American Citizens Alliance, the Japanese American Citizens League, the Committee of 100, the United Chinese Americans, Chinese Historical Society of Southern California, and the Chinese Historical Society of America, of course, Department of Interior, and Bureau of Land Management. So the 1882 Foundation has been around since 2011, 2012. Fred's Collaborative has been around since 2015. How did the two meet? Was it simply the circle of similar interests brought those two forces together?
The APAIA Collaborative was the group that was formed with Hilda and before Fred, and the idea that we would collaborate, we being our organizations and other APIA organizations, can collaborate with the Department of Interior or Forest Service to highlight or do historical research on projects that had Asian American context to them. This comes from a larger story. So the as I said before, I sort of hinted at that traditionally when we talk about national parks and national monuments, but if you look at the whole range of national monuments and things that we have that we want to preserve, there isn't very much for Asian Americans, right? So there's a deficiency there that was noted several years ago at Department of Interior, that if we wanted to make sure that the parks attracted the diversity of the peoples that are in the United States, we need to focus on other places that the and that other, we need to have people to explain where those sites are for us. And that's not just for Asian Americans, but also maybe Hispanic Americans and other people of this sort. And so about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a desire to have Department of Interior want to do a survey of potential sites that could be made into either landmark historical registration or landmark status or monument status, so that we make sure that our parks and our places were representative of the diversity of the American people.
And to Fred, this sounds like a match made in heaven. Your group, formed on a forest in California, is now connected with an organization recognized nationwide that could greatly expand a dream into reality, to be experienced and available for future generations.
So I met Ted and Ted Gong and John Cusano through our Asian Pacific American Heritage Collaborative. And John Cusano actually worked for the Forest Service at one time. And so he had that connection with the Forest Service. But, you know, when we shared a lot of the similar goals and mission of trying to engage underserved communities. And so we you know, as a, you know, as a member of the Heritage, Asian Pacific American Heritage Collaborative, this is just collateral duty for me, because, you know, as a district ranger, I got a lot of other things to do. And so one of the things that I learned from one of my mentors is you always get partners to do the heavy lifting. And so 1882 Foundation was the one that was willing to step up do a lot of that heavy lifting. Originally, it was the Chinese Historical Society of America to help create the website. And now it's the 1882 Foundation that's willing to help us generate these tours and kind of move forward with some of the film that we're trying to produce.
Well, we've hinted at it. Let's talk about it. Tours. Ted, tell us about how, for instance, I mentioned railroads as one of the features on the website that you can go explore. You can actually go to it. You can go take a tour and actually visit the site. So explain to the listeners a little bit about how that got started.
The Park Service did a couple of surveys, and one of the surveys was this Asian American themes, what we call the Asian American theme study. And we're identifying places that could potentially be, or, you know, story sites that could be made into historical registries or into monuments or whatever. And so among those things that we were looking at Asian American sites in California, and we eventually got to focus on the Summit Tunnel. And Summit Tunnel wasn't really our main interest area. We were looking generally just to find Asian American sites. As the 150th anniversary was coming up, and that was in 2017, I was saying to people, we need to focus on the transcontinental, the anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad. And the best site to think to do that is the Summit Tunnel, because everybody's going to go to Promontory. And we figure, well, let's look at this one. And this one happens to be the one where we can most illustrate Chinese American, the Asian American theme. And so this became and all the other sites that fed into it, and that got us into the California gold mines, into the fishing industries, the Napa wine country, all these other things. We began to think that, well, we could also go to the Nevada silver mines and the bauxite mine. So the idea was generally to look at Asian American themes. But the more and more we looked at it, the more and more it became obvious to us that the best representative of Asian American contributions to American history and illustrating their contributions, plus places that would interest Chinese Americans or Asian Americans to go visit park sites and stuff, was the Summit Tunnel.
Let's talk about the Summit Tunnel. A few years after its 150th anniversary, Summit Tunnels 6 and 7 of the Transcontinental Railroad was identified as a 2021 National Trust for Historic Preservation Most Endangered Historic Places in America list. This is all on the ExploreAPAHeritage.com website. Here's some of the things that I certainly jotted down that were of interest to me. The Chinese immigrants that were here certainly helped complete the Transcontinental Railroad through the Sierra Nevada. At the height of their workforce, there was 12,000 Chinese, which made up about 80% of the workforce of the, at that point, called the Central Pacific Railroad. There are 13 tunnels through the Sierra Nevada, including the 1,687-foot Summit Tunnel Number 6. That's crazy. Black powder was used to blast through this granite. Later, nitroglycerin certainly made the job a little easier, yet not even close safer. It mentions on the website the appalling conditions, austere weather that they had to endure during the years 1865 to 1867. Now, I understand there are guides that can be downloaded for those who want to know more or maybe can't get to the sites. But in regards to the train tours, Ted, can you share more on that and then toss in some interesting history?
we eventually came to the idea that the 1882 Foundation, in partnership with the U.S. Forest Service and particularly the one at Lake Tahoe area, would develop the tour up to the Summit Tunnel. The Summit Tunnel is near Lake Tahoe, and that's where the Transcontinental crossed the Sierra Nevada Mountains. So we developed an overnighter tour rather than the week-long tour that that was developed for the Wingloop tour or the ones that were being developed for out of California, out of Los Angeles, and the other APIA tours. We just thought they were too long. And so we worked with the U.S. Forest Service to overnighter tour and moved from Sacramento to the Summit Tunnel in Lake Tahoe, overnight in Reno, and then took the train back to Sacramento. So that, and along the way, we would stop at mining sites or sites related to the railroad. And the highlight, of course, was to go toward the Summit Tunnel. And if you are ever riding, driving up to Reno between Sacramento and Reno, and you use Highway 80 just off the peak, there is a just at the very top area, you go over and see where the tunnels were actually built. And if you ever look at the Sierra Nevada mountains that place, you realize it's almost pure granite, right? Crossing at that place. One of the three national projects that President Abraham Lincoln initiated, the Pacific Railroad Act, and to build the first transcontinental railroad. In order to cross it with a train, you had to dig this tunnel. Trains can't have a gradient higher than 2%, right? So you had to build this tunnel. Then realized all these guys were working with hand tools. Can you imagine that? You just have sledgehammers and you have these iron picks. And then at that time, it's in the right after the Civil War, but you really didn't have dynamite either. You had gunpowder and you had things of this sort. So people would sort of like hack away to build this granite and bore a little hole there and stuff up some gunpowder there and then blow it up, right? It's the highest tunnel ever built at that time. So the technology and the work, all done with human labor, and 80%, almost 90% of the workers were Chinese laborers recruited to do this. The engineering, the work of the laborers, what they did, and I always talk about Summit Tunnel, the longest of the tunnels. People will work from two sides of the tunnel, right? You probably know this, but that tunnel on number six, actually, if you go through the middle of the tunnel, you see a shaft that goes straight up, right? It's 85 feet high. And so what they did was, working on the tunnel was so arduous and so long and backbreaking that they decided that instead of just working from east to west, so you have two faces working so that you join in the middle, so that's an engineering thing. You have to figure out how to get the diggers from the east side and the west side to come together at the right place. But what they did was they went up to the top of that place, dropped the tunnel straight down to where the railroad bed would be, 85 feet, and started digging outwards. So you have four faces. You would bring in workers from the top, drop them into that shaft, and then have them start building an outward floor. Can you imagine that? And they were doing that. In order to do that sort of thing, they had to dismantle a railroad engine to take it up to the top to be the engine that did pull that stuff up, pull the debris up, as well as drop the men down to work. And they worked through the winter. I don't know if you've been up there in the winter, but, you know, the snow, that's one of the deepest places where you have great skiing there. But the people had to, the workers at that time, had to go work on the tunnel shaft, and their camps, from their camps to the places where they were working, you had to go through snow tunnels to get to those places to work on the tunnel. And then they had those sheds, miles of snow sheds that were built first by wood, and then now there's concrete. But you know, the tunnel itself, tunnel 6 and 7 and those other ones, they haven't been used by Amtrak or Union Pacific for the last 20 years. There have been other tunnels that dug that are more efficient and bypass those tunnels.
What about preservation? I've hiked to a few of the tunnels, and I've seen many popular, quote-unquote, special places that without, like, I leave no trace visitor guide, the area will be negatively impacted.
Did you notice the graffiti on the wall? The graffiti is terrible. People are beginning to basically deface this, what should be a monumental achievement for American history, so significant American history. And all you're doing, and people are just painting. And I'm talking about really complicated graffiti to the extent where you have a graffiti community or a community artist who believes it's their right to paint there and to do things. So I remember there are different kinds of you go on the website and people say, did you go see the tunnels? And did you see all the blue monsters that were on the wall? Did you find that? It's sort of like this historical significance where you still see the holes that were being drilled for the dynamite blasting and how many, almost 2,000 workers were killed building the railroad from beginning to end. But it's just being now as seen as a place where these graffiti artists can go over there and just paint at their will. And that has to be controlled. There isn't, you know, the tunnels themselves are still owned by Union Pacific. And it's not really, they aren't really open to the public. Union Pacific has no trespassing signs in the tunnels. And so we actually, when we run our tours, we respect Union Pacific's control of the place. And we just take people through the portals and show what's going on. But of course, everybody walks through the tunnels. And they're tramping through the encampment, the campsite that's nearby, which most people don't realize that there was a campsite there next to the Tunnel 6, near the Tunnel 6, which had almost 3,000 laborers there. You can still see some of the hearthstones where dinners were cooked and people lived. And there's also Indian pictographs, and people are tramping all over those places. So there needs to be a little bit of more control. And you ought to respect it. You ought to respect the lives that went into building it.
Well, it certainly sounds like you're gaining traction and heading into this with a full head of steam. So what's next? What's the next milestone?
I hope we can get more and more kids over there to see and understand what the significance of it is. But, you know, at the summit site, there isn't even an official historical plaque that explains what is happened in that construction area. So anyway, let me step back. Going back to one of the original ideas that we had with the heritage tours and with History in Places was to develop public-private partnerships and how to become stewards of the space, right? And so the idea is that there are any number of individual organizations, whether it's the Donner Historical Society or even Nevada County or other people who says, yes, we need to protect the site, but there isn't a single authority to do that, right? And so one of the things we want to do, of course, is to nominate it for a National Historic Landmark. That provides an ability or an umbrella thing to look to define the space. And then, but as important as that designation is, then it is important to establish at the site, not at another place, with the Forest Service land offices, but a site or program there that can be managed jointly with, say, Sugar Bowl Ski Resort or the Donner Ski Sport, Ski Ranch area and other private concerns, and establish a program there that can explain where the trails are, have docents there that can guide people, define the trails so they don't be so invasive in terms of how they create the trails. And so you would have a space there. But there is an importance to do this, because if I want to take my daughter up to the summit tunnel or another place, say at a fort or something of this sort, I would like to say that this place has become so important because it embodies or it shows all the national values that we want to pass down from generation to generation. So that designation is important. It's not just important for our urban Chinese community, but I think it's important for all Americans to know these sites.
How about you, Fred? And what were some of the impressions and feedback from the APA collaborative with these tours. Didn't this spur another special project?
Currently, we're holding a lot of tours on the Summit Tunnel. Just last month, we had a tour with about 15 folks on there. Many of them Asian Pacific Americans interested about their cultural heritage. So we are kind of achieving that goal of reaching out to underserved communities. And now we're kind of branching into the film business. Now, Joe Flanner, who's a former Forest Service employee, went out on his own and created this really excellent film called Legacy, Forest Service film. And it basically told the story of how the Chinese pioneers came over to build, to help build the western portion of the Trans-Colonial Railroad, including climaxing over at the Summit Tunnel. And what I was really impressed about this film was it wasn't just a documentary about the Summit Tunnel. It was telling a story of many of the participants on the tour and other folks that made it really interesting.
The 20-minute legacy film can be found on the ExploreAPAHeritage.com website by scrolling all the way down. You can also search for it by Legacy Forest Service. It is on YouTube. The film, produced by and directed by Joe Flannery, with the help by Gigantic Film Company, is about the Chinese workforce and their efforts to build the Transcontinental Railroad through the Sierra Nevada and how instrumental they were in its completion. However, the follow-on history excluded them from this historic accomplishment. The years that followed, culminating to the 150th anniversary of the Golden Spike, corrected that mistake, and the legacy film brings that awareness to those that watch it beautifully. But now, Fred, did this create another opportunity to continue the story?
When the film came out, I was still working with the Bureau of Land Management, and I felt really excluded. I thought, oh, shoot, there's a Forest Service film, and it's a great film. Why can't BLM be included in it? So I managed to get some funding from the BLM and partner with the Forest Service say, hey, you know, the Chinese pioneers made more than just railroad tunnels and railroads. People need to know about that. So let's try to make a film about something more broader to include both the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to kind of highlight some of these cultural heritage sites that we found on our own on some of our BLM and Forest Service sites. And so we were able successfully to hire Break Tide Productions to help us make this film. And so we're in the process of getting the storyboard and developing the story, and we're giving a lot of leeway to the artist because she has a Jelena King Lee has a really, she's sixth generation Chinese American, and so her family has been here for a while, and so she has a lot of stories to tell regarding her family. We just asked them to weave some of our cultural heritage sites into that story because they're often connected together. And so we're going to be really excited once this film comes out.
That sounds like another amazing opportunity to showcase the many heritage sites on the website. Ted mentions going beyond the simple paper recognition and ensuring a multifaceted outreach is achieved to keep this awareness and acknowledgement at the surface of future generations' conscience. Thoughts on that, Fred?
As a kind of a member of the Asian Pacific American Employees Association, we are trying to promote some of those sites on really those forests that have a lot more cultural heritage resources, Asian Pacific American resources, such as the Tahoe National Forest. We also have, as I mentioned before, the website. And part of that website, we kind of advertised for it, was we have this little app that kind of piggyback on. And so you can download that app and it'll take you a lot to these sites to visit some of these sites if you don't have time for the tour. And it's pretty interesting and you know, discovering some of these things yourself on some of these archaeological sites themselves. I think one of the proudest accomplishments was, you know, the website bringing in Asian Pacific American interns to help us out with some of these websites and going out there and exposing them to the Forest Service. And ultimately, I've been doing kind of this Asian Pacific American Heritage Collaborative for a while now. And so, and this district here that I happen to be working on is pretty busy. So what we're hoping to do is some of the old timers are trying to pass that on to the incoming new generation of Asian Pacific American Forest Service employees to kind of carry the torch, because there's a lot more to do. There's a lot of different other ways to engage underserved communities. One of the ideas that I thought was good was, creating a children's book just to kind of illustrate some of the contributions to kids, to younger kids, just to show them their heritage and kind of educate them about, hey, they're not the perpetual foreigners that other people often portray them to be. Their ancestors has been here in the United States for generations, and they contributed to building of America, just like the other immigrants that have passed through, the Irish, the Italians, and that sort of stuff. And so they should be proud of their heritage. And we just wanted to kind of show them that that they belong here in the United States.
Ted, wrap it up here with some final thoughts on just the overall topic of showcasing Chinese heritage at sites that are on national forests and beyond.
And of course, we're looking at things, how do you tell stories beyond a museum? So getting out to the sites and things of this sort are always been themes of ours. History and places are concepts which the Department of Interior's Education Group has developed several years ago before it became fashionable now to talk about museums without walls. So all these things are aspects of what we want, and that's the connection that we have with the Forest Service particularly, but also with outside places. A lot of the lands that we go to are, when people were doing historical preservations, you sort of looked at the architecture, how the architecture still retains its the integrity of the architecture. But for Chinese Americans, or a lot of us ethnic Americans, our buildings aren't architecturally so significant. But the best story sites are the places where the camps were, right? Where the frontier is. And so we've always had this idea that we would connect with the people that are more, I'd rather be out there and looking at being there where the history was made in the raw part of the countryside and so forth.
And I think many people would agree with you, Ted. There seems to be a deeper connection when you can see the land, touch the earth, breathe in the surroundings. Like you nicely put it, Ted, museums without walls. Well, a huge thank you to Fred Wong and Ted Gong for calling into the show and sharing information about the 1882 Foundation, Explore APA Heritage, the Legacy Film, and how you can learn more about visiting Chinese heritage sites on California National Forests and beyond. Thank you for listening. To learn more about the show, share it, or hear our other episodes, please search Forest Focus Podcast. And if you have questions or suggestions on a topic of area of expertise you would like us to feature, please email us at sm.fs.r5ffpodcast@usda.gov. Until next time, enjoy your public lands. And remember to recreate responsibly. Know before you go, and learn what you can do to prevent wildfires. Take care. This podcast is sponsored by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Forest Service, and the USDA is an equal opportunity provider, employer, and lender.